two students are shot on a school bus on the city's west side. The candidates for mayor and sheriff make their final appeals. And could Florida face a government shutdown? Some of the stories making headlines this week, plus a special appearance from former Mayor John Payton. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live at 9, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we've got all the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. The lines are already filling up. You can call in with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, it's a preview of North Florida's biggest beer festival. All of that ahead. But first, this morning, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly foursome here today. Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union, good morning.
Morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Weekly, or Folio Weekly, and Florida Politics.
Good morning.
WJCT analyst John Burr.
Great to be here.
And Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner.
Good morning, Melissa.
Guys, lots of news to discuss, and we'll get right to it. But first, just a few days left until the city's runoff election as voters choose in races for mayor, sheriff, and several at-large city council seats. Yesterday, historian and author Wayne Wood discussed his endorsement of Mayor Alvin Brown. This morning, former Jacksonville Mayor John Payton joins us in studio to explain his endorsement of candidate Lenny Curry. Mayor Payton, a pleasure. Thanks for coming back to the studio.
Melissa, it's been a long time.
It has been a while. And you know, you look so relaxed and happy, you kind of have to ask why these guys want the job.
That's a really good question.
But it's good to have you on the program. And you, along with former Mayor John Delaney, have endorsed Lenny Curry in this race. And what led to that decision?
You know, Melissa, I've been relatively quiet, really, for 4 years, and I worked closely with Alvin Brown when he took office. Full disclosure, I voted for him, really, when this election started coming to reality, I felt like I had a moral obligation, having spent two terms, 8 years in office. Felt like I really had strong feelings and a strong opinion on it, and it's really centered around two things. One is our city finances are an absolute disaster, and we have a $1 billion pension obligation with no sight and no solution in sight with pension reform. We're further away now than I think we were in 2011 when I left office. Our bond ratings have dropped. The New York rating agencies have said we're a more risky investment. That is costing taxpayers money because the cost of money, the interest we pay on debt now is going up. And I think, you know, the way the government's being run, there are people in key positions that I think are not qualified to be holding positions, particularly in the finance and accounting shop. And as I told Mayor Brown when we started, I said, look, when the money's not right, nothing is right. You've got to get the money right. And I shared my initial concerns with some of the appointments he was making. And I think as we play it out, you know, I think more of this, another 4 years of this would set us back. And so I've weighed in. It's uncomfortable. I don't like being critical of anyone who sits in the chair. It's a hard job. But in this case, I think we're in trouble. You overlay the financial mess with the crime. You know, we had a program in place that was getting traction, was making a difference. But I read the headlines this morning. I know you're going to cover it on your show. We have a major crime crisis in this city. And I think we have an absentee leader on this issue, and it has to be led from mayor's office. There's no other person that can do it. The sheriff is important, but by the time you know the blue uniforms show up, the crime has already been committed. There's got to be a prevention and intervention component. It requires a lot of investment. Investments that are not really people are not enthusiastic about making, but you've got to do it if you're gonna change the trajectory of violence. So I think we're at a turning point here. I think this election's important. And I think Lenny Curry, you know, I've known Lenny for years. I think he's got a skill set that is really necessary right now, being a CPA. I know his kids go to school with my kids at public school, and I've known him. He's a man of integrity. He's hardworking. He's smart. I think he'll surround himself with people, and I think he'll listen.
Yesterday on this program, historian Wayne Wood, in making his case for Alvin Brown, pointed out that, and he mentioned you by name actually, saying you were a mayor who had stumbles and mistakes in your first term, that it's a vertical learning curve, in his words, and that though that there have been problems, the city is on a roll, there is momentum, and that it's better to have someone who's had 4 years of experience in the office rather than, in his words, to hire a rookie with no government experience.
I think the learning curve is real. I had a very steep learning curve. We did stumble, no doubt about it. It took a long time. I said, look, by the time I left office, we finally started to figure out how to do the job. But this is different. We have serious problems, and I think we need a new leader. I think if we were a sports team, we'd be hiring a new coach. If we were a publicly traded company, we'd be finding a new CEO, and our stock would have dropped. I just this is a situation where we need drastic change. We need a mayor that's not traveling, a mayor that's engaged, a mayor that can have a substantive conversation on policy, which I don't think we have today. We can't delegate these things. We can't delegate pension negotiations. We can't put it off on task force. You know, I watched the debate last night, and the mayor's answer to many of the issues was, well, I formed a task force, or I've asked the general counsel to study it. And oh, by the way, we need to raise minimum wage. You know, and so it was I think the city deserves better. And that's why I've taken a stand, and that's why I've spoken up.
Yeah, we talked in the green room a little bit, so you're going to understand this question. You know, regarding the debate last night, what jumped out at me was the dysfunction in the relationship between Brown and Rutherford. It seems like they don't dialogue. Lenny kept trying to get him to say, well, how many times have you talked to him in the last year? How many times have you met with him? And he couldn't give a specific answer. He said, well, I'm praying for the city, which is not a specific answer. I guess my question to you is Brown's campaign suffering because it's being run by the Florida Democratic Party in terms of the messaging, in terms of the fundraising, all of these things? If he had more of a local operation like he did when you ran, do you think he'd be better off?
You know, it's interesting, just as someone who follows politics, I spend a lot of time thinking about the decisions they're making and what's behind the decisions. But I noticed in the debate last night, Mayor Brown's answer to almost every question, whether it was pension reform or crime, was raise the minimum wage. And that tells me it's strictly, it's got to be driven by some polling that his base, this is the number one issue with his base. And but it was just, it struck me as odd. And I think there is a disconnect. I think there's a disconnect with the crisis we're having here around crime and financial matters, and this the polling of what Democratic voters want to see.
Yeah, John, you know, what people don't know Lenny Curry very well. You know him better than most of the average people. So give us a reason to vote for Lenny Curry besides the fact that he's an accountant.
Yeah, and listen, it's hard to get excited about accountants. I get that. I've known Lenny for years. We're neighbors. You know, my kids go to school with his kids. I know Molly. This is my impression. Lenny is, I think he's kind of shy by nature. He's not, I wouldn't describe him as a real extrovert. He has a burn for public service, and he's got a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy. He's very competitive, which I think is a good thing. He's did well in school. He worked for a top, you know, accounting firm in this country. He started his own business. He's got a lot of get up and go. He's, you know, one thing he kept saying last night in the debate, he said, I will be accountable. I'm not going to blame former mayors. I'm not going to blame the sheriff. I'm not going to assign things to task forces. I'm going to be accountable. And I think that really kind of captures it. I found him to be a really solid person. And I would imagine that he will hire great people around him. I think he will tap the tremendous resources in this community of knowledge and experience to make sound decisions. Will he give the most charismatic rotary speech? Probably not. Will he be a good manager? Can he embrace a vision? He can. But listen, folks, until we get our financial house in order, it's hard to talk about vision. It's you've got to get the basics. We're not blocking and tackling. We're spending so much time fighting over the way we run the government that it's hard to get beyond that. And I think that's why we need a new CEO. We have a strong mayor form of government here. It's one of our greatest competitive advantages as a city. People come here to observe our governance model, and it's a huge advantage. What has happened under this administration, in my opinion, is basically the strong mayor form of government has been handed over to the city council. They're taking the responsible decisions on budget. Department heads go to them for direction and leadership because they're the ones that are restoring their funding. I've never seen, it's almost like it's opposite day. It's amazing to me that the mayor would propose a budget that his own appointees speak against. his appointees go before city council, say, let me tell you why this budget is bad for our city and bad for this department. The city council then restores their funding. And so a relationship is established where you have 19 council members that are basically running this government by committee that all have their own agendas. And let me tell you, we're very fortunate to have the Bill Gulliford's of the world and others that have really done a great job, I think, providing leadership on the city council. But they're not designed to run this government. 19 people with their separate agendas are not designed to do that. And that's why you see all these issues with non-delivery of service. For someone who's been there, it's astonishing to watch. I have to tell you, never seen anything like it.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to appear on this program. It's been a while, so we welcome you back, and we thank you for coming through the show.
Melissa, thank you.
Former Mayor John Payton weighing in on the election just a few days before voters go to the polls. Actually, early voting is underway, and the lines are jammed. We'll go to your calls in just a moment. At 549-2937 as we discuss the city's mayor's race. Mayor Payton, thanks for joining
us. Thank you,
Melissa. All right, let's go to the roundtable. Fred Matthews, you've been sitting quietly. Let's begin with you as we are a few days out, and you slide over to that microphone. We're going to get your thoughts as we kick this roundtable off.
Well, I didn't want the mayor to leave quite yet, but because it is politics, and that's the season we're into. One of the things the mayor alluded to last night, it's been talked about a lot, how important is this seat to retain for the Republican Party? As Mayor Payton indicated, he stumbled a great deal in his first term. Many people, he came into office without any real political background, but one of the things we pointed out was that he at least had some knowledge of the communities that he was going to be working with. And that's one of the key components that's here. And I think that's one of the things we're going to have to look at going forward and what the voters are weighing this weekend, whether or not you want to start over again or whether or not you want to try to improve on what you already have. Because the only issue at hand is the pension deal, which is, of course, hurting us. We all understand that. But the other thing is whether or not this money business is real as we go forth. And it has not been sold to the public at large except through these debates.
John Burr.
Well, I think that speaking for John, I think he would say, and he's still sitting here, so he can speak for himself, but I think he would say switching horses and midstream may not be a good idea, but we're in a situation where we're not even doing the basics right, the blocking and tackling, as he said. So, in that case, let's get somebody in there who can. Would that be accurate, John?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I mean, in an ideal world, you would like to have someone that can continue to serve, and you're right. You do get better with time. You learn how the place works, but we've got. I think we have a crisis on our hands. We have a violent crime crisis where I think the mayor has been absent. He's defunded Jacksonville Journey, which was getting traction. And by that wasn't just my plan. That was a plan that was created by 130 community leaders that cost a lot of money. He defunded that. We've got a budget crisis where our bond ratings are going down. The budgets are, as Mayor Delaney would say, are mythical. We need someone to roll up their sleeves and take control of the situation. And I wish it were different. I think in an ideal world, you'd like to have a skill set that can serve for 8 years, but we don't have that. And I think one of the problems I would say is not the mayor himself, it's the people he surrounded himself with. I mean, there's a serious talent deficiency on the fourth floor, in my opinion.
And let's go to your calls. Richard on the west side. Go ahead, Richard.
Hey, this is Richard Clark.
Yeah, go ahead, Councilman Clark.
Thank you. I just wanted to call. I heard Mayor Payton's discussion on Alvin versus Lenny. You know, I've been finance chairman for two of Mayor Brown's budgets, and I can tell you there's nothing scarier than getting a budget from this administration. Just the errors in and of themselves, the lack of ability to actually present something that's balanced is just the weight and the extra effort that the council goes through to try to make that happen. It's just it's truly, truly a Herculean effort every year. And I keep hearing people talk about pension, and you know, we've talked around and around. We had a fabulous pension plan presented to us, and no one's talking about it. That you know, I hear Mayor Brown say, well, that the city council voted that down. In reality, what happened, we were sitting around the boardroom in our shade meeting, and Chris Hand and Alvin Brown pleaded and begged that the new council members and the old not to support that deal. That is what happened. It was not the city council's decision. I begged, Stephen Jost begged everybody to do the deal. We knew it would change things. And they didn't want to do it because it wasn't their plan. And you've seen where we are today. We knew how difficult it would be to get another pension bill passed.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, Councilman, why then are some of your Republican colleagues, Stephen Jost and Ray Holt, supporting Mayor Brown?
Well, you know, it was no surprise to any of us. Stephen has been, you know, on Alvin's side for quite some time now. And it's you know, whether they are willing to admit it or not, you know, Stephen has auspices of working for this administration if somehow Alvin Brown gets reelected. So it doesn't surprise me whatsoever. Both of those individuals have been actively helping. Some of them have family members. Bill Bishop has a family member that works for the administration, as does Ray Holt. So none of that surprises me, but, you know, no one wants to talk about those two things. You know, one has jobs, others has family members that have jobs. And that's the one of the knocks internally is that our staff, as people charged to make decisions, they're scared. They're scared to lift their head up because the standing operating procedure is if you disagree or you stand up for yourself, you get fired or demoted or both.
And that's Councilman Richard Clark calling in unprompted. Thank you for that call and your thoughts. I hate to cut you off. It's just we've got lots of people waiting on hold. Thanks, Councilman. Fred Matthews, you were shaking your head. Go ahead quickly.
It's amazing that here we are 4 years later and this inside baseball comes out from a elected council member who sat there and didn't move and didn't tell the public, didn't tell his constituency about this fight, this plea by the mayor to defeat a previous mayor's plan that they all thought was good.
Maybe he was scared.
Well, maybe he was scared, but I think he should be more scared of his constituents than of the mayor who doesn't have a vote on the council. He doesn't have a vote. They have a fiduciary duty to do their job. And if they believe that the pension deal that was laid out to them was a good one, they should have put it forth and gave it an up and down vote.
Nate Monroe.
You know, it's sort of remarkable. You know, when you listen in these last three debates and you hear just the widely divergent narratives about the city, Lenny and his allies, I mean, you just heard Councilman Clark and former Mayor Payton say, you know, the city is in financial disarray. Things are like literally on fire, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, the mayor responds to this with like literal astonishment, like this is not true. You know, the city's moving forward. Things are great. You know, I think to some extent, Lenny has been fairly effective in messaging this. I mean, it seems like we hear a lot of questions and debates about the financial state of the city in disarray. You know, the mayor had to sort of take issue with the premise of a question last night. You know, this is that is one way in which I think Lenny has been somewhat successful, is turning some of this, what might otherwise be inside baseball, into sort of a narrative in his campaign.
Speaking to one of the premier pollsters in this race, UNF's Mike Binder, he's pointed out on this program, John and AG, multiple times that when you've got a Democratic mayor who's mostly governed like a Republican, the opponent has to try to hit him on other issues like public safety and budgeting, because Alvin Brown has not let anyone get to the right of him on issues that Republican-leaning voters tend to care about. AG.
Yeah, and you've seen some paradoxical messaging. I mean, Lenny's been messaging a lot on the problems that much of the city faces, many neighborhoods like the West Side, the Grand Park area. You know, he talks about pockets of success, which are true, but the vast majority of the city is not so successful. And I want to go back to the blocking and tackling metaphor that John Payton used. We talk about not changing horses in the midstream, you don't want a rookie, et cetera. But, you know, we're in Jacksonville. We've seen the Jaguars for 20 years, and most of those years have been years of futility. If you looked at Blaine Gabbert after 3 years and said, well, we should keep him because he might develop in the next 4 years, or Byron Leftwich, or, you know, any of these, or Matt Jones, or any of these other people, you would say, have you lost your mind? So incumbency is not an argument for reelection. You know, so it's got to be weighed on the record, and that's where Curry is hitting Mayor Brown, and Mayor Brown just keeps coming back with the same talking points we've heard over and over again, and we saw in last night's debate how well they were received.
John Burr, what about the argument from Mayor Brown's supporters that, in fact, downtown is on a roll, there have been new jobs created, and that things are on the upswing? What about that argument?
Well, downtown is on a relative roll to where it was. I don't think it's like a booming, as the mayor says. I wouldn't go that far. But it raises the question, how much of that is due to what Mayor Brown has done, and how much is due to you know, just the marketplace really starting to respond to downtown? You know, in response to Nate's point about the he said, she said, or whether the city's in financial difficulty or not, you know, yeah, we got this debate going, but, you know, when Wall Street tells you, you know, the interest rate on your bonds is going up because we don't think you guys are taking care of the money, that's serious stuff, and that's a pretty objective look at the numbers.
Fred Matthews.
Well, it's working, and that's what campaigning is all about. The negative messaging works, and when you repeat it over and over again, people begin to believe some of it. If it weren't for the article, of course, in yesterday's TU by Dave Bauerlein that pointed out the 147 cop issue that we've heard before, we wouldn't see how the numbers would have broken down there. But the unfortunate part is that it's late in the campaign. Most people aren't going to read that. They aren't going to see it. And the commercials are going to roll through this weekend. It is a tight race. And quite frankly, Curry's team has done a great job of messaging simply on being, as we say now, an accountant. It's a good bit of messaging, and it could very well turn the tide for it.
Let's go to Jake in Bay Meadows. Hey, Jake, go ahead.
Hi, my question is for Mayor Payton. I heard last night in the debate, Mayor Brown said that some of the financial problems started under Mayor Payton's administration. I just want to know, sir, what your reply would be to that as far as him assigning the blame to you.
And he's left the studio, but we got calls about that on Tuesday as well when former Mayor Delaney was on the program. Callers really... taking issue with blaming simply this current mayor for financial issues that have festered for a long time. And supporters of Mayor Brown will say, well, he's the first mayor that's really tried to tackle this in a serious way. Well, what about that argument?
Well, I'd also say that, you know, the recession, which was a huge mess for Jacksonville and the country, started in 2008. And that was what really kicked off a lot of the revenue problems for the city.
Nate.
I mean, again, this is, you know, to Fred's point about, you know, the sort of messaging strategy for Lenny working, I would add to that, you know, the mayor's campaign has made a lot of what seems to me to be a lot of unforced errors in this campaign. And one of them has been not pushing back early enough and aggressively enough. You know, in the primary and in the general election, we've seen the Curry campaign allowed to go up on the air for weeks without response. We've seen mailers for months, you know, and there's never been this sort of aggressive pushback until probably the last 2 weeks or so. And by this point, you know, you have to sort of wonder, is this just too little too late?
Well, we'll find out in a few days, won't we?
We will.
Let's go to Linda in Deerwood. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. I'm one of your most fervent political junkies. And one of the things I've just been thinking about Mr. Curry's campaign is that he hasn't really been forced to tell us what he's going to do. He's told us that he's a business person, so is Mayor Payton. Mayor Payton is a really nice guy. I don't remember a lot of memorable things besides Journey that came out of that administration in terms of financial fit. I just think that when you ask, you can say, well, you know, Mayor Brown does the same thing, but at least we have a record to judge Mayor Brown on. Good or bad, but that Mr. Carr has been very deft at saying, so we're going to, you know, I'm going to fight crime. Well, he's not the elected sheriff. That is sheriff. You know, up to John Rutherford and find out why 12 years in a row we've been the murder capital of Florida. That's not, you know, Brown's fault. It's the dereliction of, Mayor, you know, Sheriff Rutherford. Tell me specifically, what are you going to do, the CPA, what are you going to do specifically to turn this around in 4 years? And if we're not asking him specifics, we're just going for the commercial. And it's really sad because I've seen the debates and he doesn't answer. Mayor Brown may not answer, but you've got a record. You can say, well, Mayor Brown hasn't done this. Well, what has Lenny Curry done besides run the Republican Party and not accept Medicaid expansion? Is he going to help save Shands? Is he going to talk to the Republican House? I hope so, but he hasn't been asked to clarify that. I hope people just open their minds, vote your hearts, look at the facts, and don't fall for the commercials. Thanks, guys.
Linda, thanks. AG?
Yeah, you know, the Medicaid expansion and the Shands issue actually came up yesterday in the debate, and Mayor Brown basically told Lenny Curry to go to Tallahassee and talk to the people he helped get in office. And, you know, that's really the prerogative of the mayor to do.
Well, he did go to Tallahassee.
I'm talking about Curry. I mean, Curry can't go to Tallahassee and represent Jacksonville as a candidate for mayor. That'd be a grandstanding play. He just can't make that play. He doesn't have that executive authority. And, you know, this goes back to the issue. You know, she, you know, brought up the mayor's record. Well, you know, the signature point of the mayor's record is the lack of interface with Rutherford. It's kind of like you're watching a football game again, and you're seeing the head coach and the offensive coordinator squabbling on the sideline. It looks like that, and it's not a good look, and it's what Lenny Curry is exploiting.
Fred.
Well, I mean, we cannot overlook the fact that this is a party issue. This is a clear party issue in a town that wants to be nonpartisan. This is a very important race for the Republican Party. You have a Republican sheriff, you have a Republican everything, and here this Democrat comes in and wins the top CEO spot. So there was never going to be anything. Once it was decided, and it was decided, that the forces were going to line up to make sure that Jacksonville stayed Republican, all the stops were pulled. The only difference in this race came with the endorsement that Brown was able to get from across the aisle.
Not true. Not true.
He hasn't been able to pull any across the aisle. Whether it's been for jobs, whether they were looking for jobs or they had family in the administration, there have been instances in which that hasn't happened.
The Florida Democratic Party is running that campaign.
That,
we know it.
That's true, because that's the Florida Democratic Party's job.
Don't they want to keep it Democrat?
They do, but that's their
I
job.
I think that's true on both sides.
That's true on both sides.
So I don't see the state Republican Party running Lenny Curry's campaign.
Well, look, the sheriff is Republican. Everybody's Republican on that side. They're closing ranks. All of the Republican mayors before this one have closed ranks around him. There's been only one Democrat that I was surprised that did step forward, the former mayor Jake Godbole on Brown's side, who voted against Brown when he was running 4 years ago. So we can't mistake what's taking place here and the importance of taking back this seat politically. And what the voters have got to decide is the basics, whether or not they are better off than they were 4 years ago in terms of economically and everything else, and whether or not, I mean, the issue of Shands came up last night, but what mayor or city council is going to fork up the amount of money that it will take to save Shands if the state of Florida doesn't step in and work with the federal government.
And we will talk about that issue in a minute, only because we could see a government shutdown over that issue or all around the state. But Wendy and Ortega, go ahead. Wendy, thanks to all our callers waiting very patiently. Go ahead, Wendy. Okay, Wendy, give us a call back. Andrew at the beaches. Andrew, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I watched the debate last night, and I noticed two big things. The first was the mayor's complete lack of taking any responsibility for bad things. Yes, there are some good things that happened in Jacksonville, but there have been many bad things in Jacksonville, and when those things happen, it's not him. It's city council didn't, you know, raise taxes, you know. Sheriff is in charge of enforcement of the law, and it's just one of those things where, yes, technically those are the jobs, but you are the mayor, you know, you are the head of our city, you are the spokesman. You have to take charge of these issues. And the second thing I noticed was his complete lack of taking any position when Lenny finally called out the fact that he was an Obama delegate in 2012. The mayor even looked shocked himself, like he forgot he was a Democrat. And I just think it's time for someone new in the office. We've had 4 years of mediocrity, and I think
enough about time we've had someone do it.
Thank you, Andrew. Carmen in downtown. Go ahead, Carmen.
Good morning, Melissa and gang. How's everybody?
Good. This is Carmen?
No, it's not Carmen.
Go ahead.
It's Harmon.
Harmon. Hi, go ahead.
Right. I'd like for the committee probably address. I'm a little bit concerned whether we're electing two sheriffs or a sheriff and a mayor. One example, and I'm hearing about the budget, I don't think there has ever been a good relationship between Sheriff Rutherford and current mayor. And going back to the budget time, I think there was some communication issues where maybe from the mayor perspective, the sheriff hadn't been quite forthcoming. And even after the budget, there was some information that, well, the sheriff department had a grant, and they were able to retain some officers from that point. So I think an investigation of the sheriff needs to, I guess, answer that. I'm a little bit disappointed that he endorsed somebody, and even Schoonover said when we were going through the deal with the Walmart situation, is that it was political, that he already had his man who he was going to endorse. So how much is this political coming from the sheriff? Also, with the mayor, we keep hearing about crime, crime, crime. I want to know how many jobs, how many corporations are they going to move to the west side and the north side and stop going to St. John's County, to Flagler County? That's the deal that's going to stop the crime and the gangs. And even now we're talking about giving Vistacon millions of dollars, and how many people have Vistacon laid off? How many corporations we need to go out for the clawback?
Yeah.
If we do all of that, we solve our problem.
Thanks, Harmon. One more call. Valerie on the south side. Go ahead, Val. Go ahead. Oh, we lost Valerie. Well, you know what? That's okay because we're running tight on time, and we do need to touch briefly on the other big story of the week, Florida Governor Scott telling state agencies Thursday to single out their most pressing needs and make a list of services that need to be salvaged in case of a government shutdown in July. Scott remains enmeshed in a budgetary standoff over federal health care dollars. The legislature is going back June 1st. Fred Matthews, it would not be a good situation if the government shuts down over this fight over low-income pool Medicaid funding.
Well, imagine that. Imagine that. We have the government could shut down in Tallahassee, and we elected this guy's second term. So imagine if that would be the case. I mean, look, it's a very simple fix. The legislature and the governor simply have to abide by the rules that have always been in place. If you accept the federal funds, you accept the guidelines that go with them, and your people get helped. That's what's facing them. This endless argument over Obamacare has just gone to the extreme. They aren't even talking about it in Washington, D.C. anymore. But Florida and a few other states are the last bastion of that. And it's not going to be pretty if the governor who lets this happen. But he's not going to pay for it. Those in the legislature are going to be the ones who pay for any shutdown that takes place, in particular, any shutdown that happens with Shands-Jacksonville.
Nate.
You know, this is, of course, I have no special insight into this problem, but, you know, this big fight over Medicaid expansion is really pretty interesting because I think that expanding Medicaid probably polls fairly well with most Floridians. I think that, you know, the business establishment is essentially okay with expanding Medicaid, and yet we have, you know, the state house completely against it, the governor completely against it. And, you know, this kind of logjam. And yes, it would be very bad if the state government shut down. You know, it's.
Yeah. It's been interesting to watch the negotiations. There are budget negotiations going on in Tallahassee right now to try to salvage this.
Yeah. And, you know, ultimately, I believe it's going to be salvaged. I'm optimistic. I believe a lot of this is Rick Scott playing a game of political chicken, trying to establish his conservative bona fides for a future Senate run. And ultimately, he will have to make some sort of deal. And, you know, going back to the mayoral race piece, I believe that if, you know, Alvin Brown hadn't yoked himself so much to Rick Scott before the Scott endorsement of Curry, then he'd be a more effective advocate on this issue also. So, I mean, you've got a number of competing things here. But, you know, when we get through June, something is going to happen with this. I'm sure of it.
Well, I think that's true because we on the state level, it is really you do have to balance the budget. There's no, well, maybe we'll do this and not. You have to balance the budget. This has to be done. And certainly they're going to have to make some decision on this Medicaid issue because of the hospitals that are in balance. It's not going to work. The question came up in the debate last night whether or not you would be willing to raise taxes or what you can do to save. There's nothing the city can do. To save. That's not enough money in the city coffers to do anything which stands other than what the amount of money that we gave them. So that's a non-starter. This has to be a partnership with the state government and the federal government as it has always been.
Yeah, and there had been talk of an independent taxing district in Duval County for UF Health. That's how they preserve the safety net hospitals in Miami and Tampa. Library advocates tried to float an independent taxing district for the libraries, and it failed. Voters wouldn't pass it. So you would presume from that it might be an uphill battle to get the same type of thing passed here to save UF Health and indigent care in Duval County.
I think three debates have shown us what we're going to get for answers when you ask both candidates about taxes. You know, no
specific answer?
Yeah, or no. I mean, that's,
or no new taxes. Yeah,
I mean, that's... You know, those we're not getting any more than that, at least before the election.
You know, but really, this is the thing, though. I think the future is sort of a la carte taxation, you know, self-sustaining taxing districts, and especially with the consolidated model that we have, you have a lack of accountability because it is so big, so spread out in so many ways. So, I mean, things like a library taxing district and especially a taxing district for UF Health, where people actually know what the costs are, they know what they're paying going in, and they know what's going for it, I believe that is the future.
And it's been a busy news week. Touch on one more item from the week. The two candidates for sheriff debated last night at FSCJ South's Wilson Center. They kind of refrained, Fred, from getting into personal attacks in this final bout before the election. That sheriff's contest has been an interesting one to watch as well between Ken Jefferson and Mike Williams. What are your thoughts about that race?
Well, I think they had to pull back last night because the night before that was really personal. It was really this business about mortgages and all kinds of things have just floated through that I don't think voters wanted to hear and nobody really knew about. So they had to pull back a bit and get back to sheriffing. And then, of course, they were slapped in the face with this shooting that had occurred, the school bus shooting that occurred just a couple of hours before they went on the air. So they had to talk about policing. It's going to be a tighter race than it would have been a month ago. There's no question about it. The thing that gets me a little bit is that the inarticulateness, is that a good word?
Yeah.
The inarticulateness of Ken Jefferson on some key issues for being so many years as the police spokesman to address it clearly as to what he wants to do. He, too, continues to repeat the same mantra of reducing crime by 25%, and now he's adding something to it. Versus the resume of Mike Williams, who is, as his thing says, a real cop, quote unquote. So I think they had to pull back, but it is going to be a very close race, and I don't think we should be surprised at the ending.
Nate.
I'm interested to see if there's a universe in which, say, you know, Lenny wins and Ken Jefferson wins or, you know,
the or vice
reverse.
Versa.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
That's something I'm, you know, kind of curious to see how that plays out.
That may well be. I may have a split ticket.
Yeah. And, you know, really with the sheriff's race, I mean, Jefferson's been short on details and some things, but, you know, what he's running on is really a transformational vision in terms of transforming the relationship that law enforcement has with people, you know, more of a real community policing. And, you know, the people behind him are actually thinking in the same lines, whereas, you know, Williams is a very effective exponent of the status quo. So, I mean, this is a referendum on, you know, how things have been going the last 12 years as much as how this race is going.
And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week across the state. It was hard narrowing it down to three this week, but there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Okay, only in Florida do people running to catch a plane dash across the concourse in nothing but their skivvies. 26-year-old Chris Haynes didn't make his flight after police chased him down. Haynes was nabbed running into the main concourse of Tallahassee Regional Airport, clad only in his underwear. Don't know if they were boxers or briefs, but Haynes was tased in the back and the buttocks before he was arrested. At first, the cops thought he also had nunchucks. Sadly, that was not the case.
Nunchucks.
That would have made it even better. After he was detained, Haynes said, "I kind of always wanted to be tased."
Whoa. Future legislator.
Only in Florida do people go on a violent rampage to help their imaginary friends. 75-year-old Walter Welch was nabbed in Alachua County after police say he threatened a garbage truck operator with a knife. Welch says he was trying to get his girlfriend out of the truck and the driver's clutches, but the cab was empty. Welch is arrested on charges of aggravated assault and a slew of other charges. And finally, only in Florida do people get canned after the hearse they're driving to a funeral is seen outside Dunkin' Donuts instead of going to the funeral procession.
Yeah, I saw this.
The body of Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Coleman was on the way to a service from Veterans Funeral Care in Clearwater when a driver and a licensed funeral director stopped at Dunkin' Donuts to get a snack. After a video of the incident went viral, the pit stop for the cup of coffee got the two employees fired. No word on whether they went for the iced coffee rocky road or the butter pecan latte, but there it is for you. Only in Florida. Thanks so much, guys, for being with us, and have a good weekend. Thanks to Fred Matthews, A.G. Gankarski, John Burr, and Nate Monroe. Thanks.
Thank you.
And we're back in a moment.
Join us for the radio variety show that celebrates the culture, art, and history of Northeast Florida.
Wake up in the morning, yeah.
Swamp Radio features musicians, poets, playwrights, and interviews that tell the unique story of our home.
My idea was to take them to the epicenter of Southern cooking, the Waffle House.
What you do best is most everything.
Swamp Radio, Friday evening at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
How does mental illness affect a person's work, school, or family environment? WJCT's First Coast Forum will focus on barriers to getting treatment. A panel of mental health practitioners and advocates will discuss the obstacles people with mental illness face. First Coast Forum, Breaking Through Stigma, a conversation about mental health. Thursday, May 28th at 8 on WJCT Public Television and 89.9 FM.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it's the largest beer festival in North Florida. The 7th Annual Craft and Import Beer Fest will tap the kegs tonight at the Veterans Memorial Arena. Mark Wisdom, a.k.a. the Jack's Beer Guy, is here now with a preview, and good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good to see you. Lots of excitement about this event. What's going to be happening?
Wow, it's our biggest beer event of the year. There's going to be in the neighborhood of 350 different beers to be tasted tonight from 40 different breweries around the world. It's both import and craft beers.
And there's such an audience for this. People really get into all the different options and flavors. This industry has taken off so much.
It really has. It's growing by leaps and bounds, whereas since the 90s, it's just gone crazy. Just a couple of quick notes I took on my way in this morning is the overall beer market is $101.5 billion a year. Craft beer alone brings in $19.6 billion a
year. Wow. What got you interested in it? You're the Jack's Beer Guy.
Well, I grew up in German neighborhoods of St. Louis, literally just a few blocks away from the original Anheuser-Busch Brewery, and in a German family. So I was sort of destined to have beer running through my veins my entire life.
Nice, nice. And now, though, with Florida passing legislation that will allow people to go into a craft brewery and walk out with a growler, a really big glass, what do you think about that legislation?
Well, it's a fight that's been going on for several years, and Ben Davis at Intuition has been fighting this fight for several years quite vocally. What the difference is Florida was the only one of two states in the entire country that did not allow 64-ounce growlers, half gallon. We did allow quarts and gallons, but no half gallons. And half gallons are considered the standard of the industry. It's enough beer to enjoy with a friend, but not so much that the growler's going to go flat before you drink a whole gallon.
Why do you think it was such a fight to get this change here in Florida?
Well, there were a lot of political reasons through several different fronts. One front was it was promoting alcoholism, which to me was ridiculous because a gallon of beer promotes alcoholism more than a half gallon. And the other was that there were some laws in place that some of the major breweries didn't like. They felt that growlers would impinge upon their abilities to sell beer, so they were fighting it quite verbally.
Hmm. But now that it's gone through, the craft beer culture in Florida, like so many other states, is really flourishing.
Oh,
and it's a big part of the economy.
Yeah, it's completely and utterly exploding across the state. It's almost weekly I hear of new breweries that are opening. As a matter of fact, there's a new brewery opening today in St. Augustine called Ancient City.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, would you have a favorite place to go?
My actual favorite, as I mentioned earlier, is Intuition.
Intuition.
I practically lived there, and when they move downtown right across the street from your studios, I will most likely be a resident of there as well, because I live in Springfield, and it's only a few blocks away from me.
Okay. So, tell us a little bit more about tonight. We're talking 40 participating breweries, more than 350 different beers to taste. No way you could taste it all, although I'm sure some people will try.
Some people will try. And
yeah.
I encourage that if you do try, please do not drive home. Take Uber, take Lyft, take a cab, whatever you have to do. Please don't drive home. But the idea is small tastes. A couple of ounces, taste it, see if you like it. And then if you do like it, take some notes. Write down what you liked about it. And then try and find it at your local bars, restaurants, liquor stores, grocery stores, whatnot.
Do you do it like flights of wine? Just, like a little array of little glasses or?
At the tasting tonight, it will be a small glass. I think everybody gets about a 4-ounce glass, and usually they only fill them about halfway so that you get an idea of the taste of the beer and the mouthfeel of it and everything. But you don't have to worry about getting too much of it if you don't like it.
Is the beer crafting industry on a level now with wineries, do you think, in terms of seeing the craftsmanship of it and all of that?
There are some people that would argue that beer is even more of an art than wine is. Wine has two ingredients. It has grape juice or fruit juice and yeast. Beer has four at the very least. It has grains or malts. It has water, yeast, and hops. And by changing the combinations of each of those ingredients, you become able to change the flavors and put different types of profile into the beer. There's an awful lot of variables to go through. It has to do with the amount of time that the beer is actually brewed. It has the amount of time it's stored, how it's stored, if it's stored in a wooden cask, if it's stored in just a regular metal fermenter. So there's a lot to it. And you'll see that a lot of new restaurants that are opening up are really getting on board the craft beer boat, because beer pairs with food as well as, or even better than, wine does. Just this week alone, I've gone to two different beer dinners, and there was one that I wasn't able to make this week, so it's been crazy.
Wow. Well, again, this is tonight, the 7th Annual Craft and Import Beer Festival at Veterans Memorial Arena, kicking off at happy hour, right?
Yes. It's open to VIP ticket holders at 5 and general admission at 6.
And walk-ups are fine, of course.
Sure,
it's kind of a walk-up city, so you might get some...
It is a last-minute city.
Yeah, yeah. Where can they find you? Do you have any favorites that you're going to be sampling?
I'll be walking around all night. I'll have my black... beer guy t-shirt, or not t-shirt, but work shirt on. I'll be walking around talking to people, just asking them questions, how they're liking it and everything. I'll be hanging out in the VIP area for a while, and I'll be helping judge the Guinness Perfect Pour contest tonight.
Very nice. Well, it's Mark Wisdom, a.k.a. the Jag's Beer Guy, and again, the 7th Annual Craft and Import Beer Festival tonight at the Veterans Memorial Arena. Have fun out there. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Questions or comments, go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday, and we want to mention something quickly. Join us for a conversation next week of the American classic Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow. Do you think ragtime resonates with the contemporary issues of today? We want your thoughts. Questions and comments, go to bookclub@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.